Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah Lake's algal bloom is causing problems in Salt Lake and Davis counties. Davis County Attorney Troy Rawlings seeks dismissal of the charges against former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. A caregiver of a Utah man who died from Zika virus has also contracted the virus, or been infected with the virus. And presidential candidate Donald Trump receives the Republican nomination at the party's national convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Those and other topics on the show today. Joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Ben.
Also with us, environment reporter Emma Penrod. Welcome, Emma.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
Health reporter Alex Stuckey. Good morning, Alex.
Morning.
And justice and safety reporter Jennifer Dobner is with us as well. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join the conversation. What caught your attention from this past week's news? Put your comments and questions in the comments section at sltrib.com, or you can call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Dan Harry, let's start with the Republican National Convention and Donald Trump's nomination. Utah delegates were in the middle of a floor fight early in the week. What happened there?
Well, the whole week, Utah was kind of earned a reputation as not being Trump fans. They went to the convention in Cleveland as supporters of Ted Cruz, the Texas senator, and they were not shy about expressing their sort of displeasure and skepticism of Trump. So they started off by trying to do this rule change that would have allowed other candidates to be brought forward for the nomination. That was unsuccessful, stopped in part with the efforts of Enid Green, our former congresswoman who was the Rules Committee chairwoman. But they also were clearly unenthusiastic for most of the convention about the Trump nomination. They got the nickname as the Never Clap Delegation. And they showed a little bit more life last night as Trump was receiving his nomination, but still not the kind of enthusiasm you saw 4 years ago when Mitt Romney was the nominee.
I also saw on Twitter there seemed to be some confusion after the state votes when Utah's delegation declared their votes for Ted Cruz,
right,
and the committee chairman then ruled the votes in favor of Donald Trump. What was behind that switch, and do you think it matters to the average Utah Republican voter?
No, I don't think it matters at all. It was a sort of symbolic defeat for the Cruz people, and I think for Senator Mike Lee personally. They cast all 40 votes for Ted Cruz, but because of rules, Ted Cruz was no longer an actual official candidate. They couldn't be counted, so they immediately went to the Trump column.
I also saw Utah GOP Chairman James Evan predicted that Utah would deliver Trump's highest margin of victory in November. You were a little skeptical of that.
I am skeptical of that. I think that is an overly optimistic calculation of where we are. If you look at the most recent polls, the best that Trump's doing is pulling a few percentage points ahead of Hillary Clinton. And in our most recent poll, which was back in June, they were dead even. One of the complicating factors is you have a Libertarian candidate this year who is going to be the fallback position for a lot of people who still are never Trump. Gary Johnson, who's the former governor of New Mexico, and he also has his vice presidential candidate is a former Republican governor, Bill Weld of Massachusetts. So those are sort of the most acceptable to mainstream Republican libertarian candidates we've seen in a long time, and I'm sure that they'll have some attraction. My guess would be they would pull mainly from the Republican side.
For much of this year's campaign, there was speculation that there could be a contested convention, something that hasn't happened since 1976. That didn't happen. Trump was able to secure the votes he needed. But it seemed like some of that division lingered towards the convention.
Absolutely. And the most clear sign of that was Wednesday night when Ted Cruz was given a primetime speaking spot and yet did not endorse Donald Trump. And he came onto the stage with cheers and a lot of excitement, people who had voted for Cruz in the primaries and still supported him. But by the time it was over, he left the stage among boos. And, I've never seen anything like it. I've seen a lot of conventions. I've attended a lot myself. I've never seen anything like that. Usually these are big orchestrated set pieces that has the single goal, the single most overriding goal is to show unity. And that was exactly the opposite of what that did on Wednesday night.
So booze for Ted Cruz, and then Donald Trump made his big speech last night. You know, how is that received, and does it look like the party is more unified today than it was last week?
They say so, but I think a lot of that is, you know, they're expected to say so. It was a very unusual acceptance speech last night, a very dark speech. The America that Donald Trump painted was one that is crime and violence ridden. It sounds like one of those futuristic, you know, leaving New York or where dystopia has taken over. You're burning cars in your street and, you know, you're trying to get out. That's what kind of the America that he portrayed last night. And I don't think that's the America that most of us see. Obviously, he's trying to play upon Americans' fears, insecurities. And I guess we'll see if that works.
A quick reminder to listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Dan, Harry, one of the other big stories from this week was Melania Trump's speech. Many criticize as potentially plagiarizing a paragraph from Michelle Obama's 2008 convention speech. In fact, a University of Utah alumna was identified as a speechwriter, and she apologized for the mistake. How are people reacting to that controversy?
I think that one's over, but it lasted a good 2 days. It burned up a lot of the political oxygen over that. And, you know, it was kind of one of those typical Trump controversies where everybody agrees there's a problem except Donald Trump and denied that there was any hint of plagiarism in these comments that followed pretty closely to comments Michelle Obama had made in 2008 and, you know, denied that there was any problem. And then, like 2 days later, as you said, the speechwriter offered to resign, apologized, and it fairly quickly after that blew over. There are now conspiracy theories that this was a deliberate ploy on the part of Trump just to, you know, get more publicity.
Obviously, we'll have a quick break before the Democratic National Convention starts up next week. Any predictions for what we might see there or what all this means for November?
It'll be very quick. Yeah, that starts Monday, and we expect perhaps as early as today to find out who Hillary Clinton's running mate will be. There's a lot of speculation about that. A lot of people think she'll go the safe route and pick Tim Kaine, who's you know, a moderate Democrat. There are people out there pulling for Elizabeth Warren, who would bring, I think, a lot more excitement to the ticket. So that'll be kind of the opening gambit of the Democratic convention. I think what you'll see next week is a lot more scripted, traditional convention where people are unified and they are in love with the nominee and, you know, try to get us all to love the nominee. I don't think it will be as interesting television as the Republican convention was.
You mentioned the polls in Utah showing, you know, relatively little support for Donald Trump. Does anyone on Hillary's shortlist for vice president have, you know, could anyone impact her chances here in Utah?
You know, I think always the vice presidential nomination is overrated. There are very few times, I think, when it really makes a difference. There are people now, like Governor Gary Herbert, who are kind of using the vice presidential nominee as cover to say, well, he's going to vote for Donald Trump because Mike Pence is acceptable to him. You know, people don't really vote for vice presidents.
Great. Well, thank you, Dan. Harry, switching topics, Emma Penrod, you've reported on the Utah Lake algal bloom. What is an algal bloom? What's causing it? And what's changed in the last few days?
All right. So an algal bloom, just in general, would be when you've got algae or microorganisms in a body of water that are multiplying rapidly, much more beyond what's normal. Right now, the particular organisms involved are cyanobacteria, which are, yes, bacteria, but that are considered to be algae in terms of their behavior and the way they act in the water. So these are potentially poisonous microorganisms that remain, you know, they're in the water all the time. They're natural parts of water, But they aren't normally harmful because they aren't usually in large quantities. But when you get the right conditions, they go a little crazy, and you get what we see now where, you know, the water turns green and it's potentially toxic.
You mentioned the right conditions. I mean, is it weather? Is it, and what are those conditions, and why is this happening now to such a large degree?
Oh, it's a combination of a lot of things. It is weather, partially related, because these microorganisms, they prefer, you know, placid water that's not very not moving very fast. They prefer warm water. So the fact that we've had warm, calm weather for quite a while has not helped us out. The fact that the lake level is lower than normal is not helping anyone out. And they also, you know, they like food and nutrients. So if you put a lot of certain pollutants like nitrates and phosphates into a body of water, you're feeding them.
Mm-hmm. Water quality officials announcing this week that the algal bloom is spreading along the Jordan River. What areas are impacted? How far has this gone so far?
I don't know that it's known exactly how far it is. There's sampling going on, ongoing still, to try to determine the extent and where exactly everything is. It was found in samples yesterday from Davis County, but only in small numbers. And it's not clear, because there aren't background samples available to compare it to, whether that's because the algal bloom is moving toward Davis County, or whether it's because they were just there to begin with.
For property owners along the Jordan River, what are they being advised to do, or what does this mean for them?
Well, the algae aren't going to jump out of the water and get you yet.
Lucky for everyone.
This isn't actually a horror movie, despite some jokes that have gone around. The main thing, you do not want to drink the water. The water is not safe to drink. You don't really want to be in the water either. Some people will have reactions just from touching the algae, so you might get a rash or that kind of thing from being in contact with it. But, you know, don't drink the water, and don't let your pets drink the water either, because most people, they look at a bright green lake and they don't really feel tempted to drink that. Your dog, sorry, dogs are dogs. So, you know, that's the main advisory right now. There's also advisories in place that nobody should be using water that is sourced from Utah Lake or the Jordan River to water crops or any kind of vegetables or anything. There's concerns that the toxins could be absorbed into the plants and into the vegetables themselves. And, of course, nobody can use this water for livestock right now.
Have there been any reports of animal deaths? I remember, was it last year a dog died at Utah Lake?
That, I believe, was in 2014, that there were two dog deaths that were connected to a much smaller algal bloom in Utah Lake. I haven't heard any confirmed deaths yet. There has been talk that maybe there were some birds, but that has not been confirmed that I have heard yet.
Mm-hmm. And water quality officials, are they, how would you describe their optimism, or at least what they're publicly stating?
I think right now they're just still trying to monitor the scope of this. Utah has never seen an algal bloom like this before. The previous algal bloom in Utah Lake in 2014, we were talking hundreds of thousands of cyanobacteria per milliliters is how they measure it. Levels right now, or at least in the last count that I saw in Utah Lake, were in the tens of millions. So this is exponentially larger than the one that was associated with those dog deaths. This is the first time that they've seen the algal bloom actually move down the river and into multiple counties. So I think that there's really just an effort right now where they're trying to find out just where is this, how many people are impacted, and how long is it going to persist is another big question that everyone is still trying to answer. As those questions are answered, the focus will probably shift more to what can we do in the future to prevent this, and there will probably, let's be honest, be some finger pointing.
Alexa, listeners, you can follow that story on sltrib.com. We're going to take a quick break. Ahead on the show, we'll be talking about an unusual case of the Zika virus here in the state and other stories. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough. Joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Emma Penrod, Alex Stuckey, Jennifer Dobner, and by editor Dan Harry. We're digging into the past week's news, and you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Alex Stuckey, moving away from poisonous water. In also health news, there's an unusual Zika case in the state. What's happening there?
So the person, they announced this earlier this week, the person who was a caregiver for the Salt Lake County man who died earlier this month, that was infected with Zika, but was not, it was just kind of a contributing factor. He had an underlying condition that they were not releasing to us. But he, this caregiver, was infected with Zika, if you will, and has already recovered. The symptoms are, for most people, pretty mild, but they're not sure how this person got Zika. They didn't have any sexual contact with anyone who had traveled to a Zika-infected area or had Zika, and he had not traveled to a Zika-infected area.
What does this mean for I guess, the study of Zika or the spread of Zika? You know, if we assume that it was transmitted in certain ways and this isn't one of those ways, I mean, what are the health officials saying?
I mean, they're saying not to panic, first of all, because they don't know what exactly happened. And they're not speculating either, of course. But the CDC is here and helping with the investigation. You know, they're testing other people that had contact with this individual and healthcare workers that had contact with the man who died to try to determine, you know, what could possibly have happened. But again, they're not, you know, they don't want anyone to panic because they don't know yet. But there are there's no evidence that there are the kind of mosquitoes that like carry Zika in the state.
Utah was the first state in the continental U.S. to see a Zika-related death, and now this case is raising questions about the virus. Is Utah just lucky? Is there a particular reason why we're getting all this Zika news here?
They don't know. There's really no obvious answer there. I mean, there are states sort of near us that have those mosquitoes that have established, Arizona and California, for example. And there have been those mosquitoes in previous years, but because our winters are so harsh, they haven't been able to establish. But I don't think Utah's just lucky, I guess. I don't think they don't have a reason for that.
You mentioned how this caregiver has already recovered and that the symptoms typically are more mild. The man who died likely had an underlying condition that we're not aware of. If not death, then what is it that we expect to see when a person is infected with Zika?
Well, a lot of people don't have any symptoms at all. But some of the symptoms are, you know, rash, red eyes, like very kind of, almost like flu-like symptoms that don't last for very long. But a lot of people don't have any symptoms at all.
Changing subjects a little bit, you had a story run online last night, and it'll be in the print edition of the Tribune this weekend, about a sexual assault case, or several sexual assault cases, at Utah State University. Give us what's happening in that case, or what happened in that case?
So basically, we found out about this by requesting police reports through an open records request in a previous story that we had done. I guess it was in May. And so there were four women, three of whom attended Utah State, who reported against the same student, saying that this student sexually assaulted them. Those three that were students, in one way or another, informed the school. And it does not appear that this student was ever disciplined.
The accused student.
Yes. Yeah, lots of students. Sorry. and police, two of the cases went to the prosecutor, but, she declined to, file criminal charges, and two of the other ones, they do not appear that they ever made it there. Although she has since us asking her about this, she has since requested all of the reports from the detective who handled the four cases.
Do we have any sense of, you mentioned the story that after these questions were raised, the prosecutor's going to combine the cases, look at them, see if there might be some prosecutable charges. Do we have a sense of why that hadn't happened earlier? I mean, some of these reports were years ago.
They were all last year.
Okay.
And the oldest one, if you will, was in January of last year. But it's not clear. She told me that she knew about all of the cases before I called her. And the police refused to talk to me. So it's not clear where the breakdown in communication was. But, you know, she now says she's going to assess them to determine if there's, you know, a pattern of conduct that she can establish and move forward with a case. So we'll see if that happens.
How does this differ from what campuses are typically expected or encouraged to do in these instances?
Well, I think the biggest issue here in terms of talking about the school is that if under Title IX, which bars sex discrimination in education, colleges, if they know of a potential threat to students, they have to act. So a student normally could file a Title IX complaint and ask for an investigation. But if they get multiple reports against the same accused student, they can and kind of have to take action, even if the victims are not willing to participate because there could be a threat to other women, in this case, on campus. And that does not appear to have happened. So sort of problematic, it seems.
You had a chance to speak with the accused student. How is he responding to these accusations?
Well, he denied them, as he did in the two cases where he was interviewed by the police. He did tell me that in one instance, although he didn't, you know, elaborate, the school did sit him down and kind of ask him, you know, what the heck, basically. But I mean, it was a lot of that, you know, that these women weren't telling the truth or whatever. And it appeared that he knew about at least one of the cases that he wasn't actually interviewed for, if you read the police report. So that's, I don't know what that means, but so, yeah.
Is there any issue of, you know, you mentioned the prosecutors re-examining these cases. Is there any issue of a statute of limitations or a time period being passed?
Utah does not have a statute of limitations for rape cases. So they could move forward. All these girls could participate. And the ones that I have spoken with are, they want to, you know, they're upset that nothing happened to this student.
And Utah's Board of Regents, they've been looking at their policies regarding these types of investigations, Title IX accusations. Last week they adopted a policy guaranteeing the right of both accuser and accused students to have representation, be that an advisor or an attorney, in their formal disciplinary hearings. Is there any sense that this new policy, if applied, would have affected these reports in any way?
Well, they would have had to get to that point. And based on my conversations with these women, they never got to that point. The school, of course, is not talking about it because of student privacy concerns. But with, you know, the ability to have an attorney with you, you have to get to the point where both of you are in the room talking about it to a board of, you know, faculty and staff. And, you know, none of these got that far.
How many of the alleged victims were you able to speak to?
So I spoke to two of them recently, one of them previously, and the fourth girl has agreed to talk to me today after reading the story. So I guess technically all of them after, you know, noon today.
Are they, you know, what are they hoping comes out of, you know, all this attention that's now being placed on the school and the police department up in Cache Valley?
I mean, I think they want to see this student punished. You know, they none of them knew each other, and they didn't know that there were so many of them that reported. And so that only made them more upset. And in one case, you know, the prosecutor and the detective, they didn't even tell the girl that they had decided not to file charges. She found out when I called her, and she called the detective to make sure talking to me wouldn't, you know, disrupt her case. She had no idea. So I think they all just feel like there was no good place for them to go, that both systems failed them. And, you know, they want to see that changed.
You mentioned that a lot of this came to light from records requests. And what did those records indicate? What do these investigations look like that, you know, in the case reports in the cases that there were?
Well, the first two in January and November were pretty thorough. You know, they were sent to the prosecutor. So they talked to any witnesses. They talked to the accused student. Of course, they talked to the woman. And the last two were pretty abruptly ended. In one case, the girl initially went to Logan Police, and because of where she lived, they transferred the case to a neighboring police department. And that police department didn't even make a police report for her case because he claims he couldn't get in touch with her, but she says, you know, she tried to get in touch with them and they just didn't call her back. Mm-hmm. And then the last one, it's not clear what happened, but the last time they tried to contact her was in January of this year, and there's nothing else in the police report. That's the end of it. And the accused student was never interviewed for those last two cases.
Dan Harry.
Yeah, could I just ask you one question, Alex, which is, you said that they're required to hold a Title IX investigation, the school, and that didn't happen. Is there any kind of sanction for that they failed to meet that requirement?
Well, the federal government could investigate. The list of schools being investigated by the federal government is incredibly long, and someone would have to lodge a complaint. And that someone could not be me. It would have to be, you know, one of the women or someone who knew about the cases. So
the prospects of them actually getting sanctioned are pretty slim, it seems like.
Right. I mean, the feds could, theoretically, the feds could see this story and go, that's not okay, and launch an investigation. But they are so, I've been told, they are so short-staffed. And the list of schools to investigate is so long that that would be pretty unlikely.
Alex, what schools in Utah have had complaints filed against them with Title IX?
Well, right now Westminster is being investigated, and I believe that investigation started last year. They say they try to complete these in 180 days, but clearly that's more than 180 days. And other someone has filed a complaint against the U and BYU, but as of last week, the feds hadn't picked up those cases. So the feds get the complaints, and then they have to say, okay, we think this is egregious enough to investigate, and they haven't yet done those in those two instances.
A lot of reports in recent months, you know, stories out of BYU, Westminster, the University of Utah, as you said, new policies by the regions. Is there any sense that Utah lawmakers might be turning an eye towards this issue in the coming session?
I don't know. They probably should. I mean, I think there's clearly a lot of evidence that this is an issue, just based on, you know, the stories that we've done. But I guess we'll see. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on this or anything else in the local news. Call us at 801-355-TALK with your questions. We can take them live on the air, or you can leave them for us to discuss. You can also comment on sltrib.com. Just follow the Behind the Headlines link on the homepage. We're going to have to take another quick break, but we'll return in a moment. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough. Joined in the studio this hour by Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, Alex Stuckey, and Jennifer Dobner. Jennifer, thank you for being patient. Big news this week in the criminal case against former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff. The prosecutor of that case, Davis County Attorney Troy Rawlings, is seeking to have all of the charges against Shurtleff dropped. What reasons has Rawlings given for his decision?
Well, he has a few. roughly about 5, actually. So Monday, early Monday morning, he filed a motion to dismiss. There's seven criminal counts, 5 felonies and 2 misdemeanors. And among his reasons are, number one, an ongoing cooperation agreement with Shurtleff to help and potentially testify in other cases, and we can talk about that in a second, and a recent Supreme Court ruling, which makes it more difficult, he believes, to prosecute public corruption. That's the McDonald case out of Virginia, in which the court sort of narrowed the scope of behaviors which they would consider, you know, problematic. And then he has some evidence issues, he believes, in some other parts of the some of the specific counts. And then there's an ongoing issue about the cooperation of the federal government, who initiated this investigation of Mr. Shurtleff and also Mr. Swallow, in terms of securing evidence in the case. Rawlings has been fighting them in the courts for about a year over things that he believes have been withheld. And under the law, if you're a defendant, you're entitled to get every scrap and shred of evidence gathered about you, because it could provide you with grounds for a defense. And Rawlings believes that he doesn't have everything that is out there, and that he cannot meet his legal obligation to Mr. Shurtleff. And so he says, you know, in the interest of justice, it's better to walk away.
It's been 2 years since the charges were filed. Could you give us kind of a quick version of the history of where these accusations stem from?
Okay, there's no quick version of this. But there were allegations of pay-to-play environment inside the Attorney General's office. So political campaign donors giving money to Shurtleff and later to Swallow, who had their own legal problems and were looking to sort of negotiate their way out of them, or getting advice and help to, you know, reach other people at higher levels of politics in order to resolve their own issues. Also, some improper gifts, trips to a luxury California resort, trips to a houseboat in St. George, flying on someone's private jet. These are all things that are in the allegations in both cases.
Now, the dismissal of the charges, that must be ruled on by a judge.
A judge.
And that has not happened yet.
No, that has not happened yet. And I should say that there are competing motions to dismiss in Shurtleff's case. His own attorneys filed 2, one in, like, I think June 25th, and another one, I think, on July 8th, where they are raising various allegations why they think the case should go. The response to that really was the prosecutor to say he's going to dismiss it himself. It's up to the judge. She has not it's a third district judge, Elizabeth Ruby Mills. She has not set a court date to, you know, discuss this with the sides. I don't know if she's read them. There's nothing on the calendar, and there are no what we would call a minute entry, which would be a note in the court docket that she's about to or has taken any action. So it's like I'm just, you know, waiting with, like, a lot of people with bated breath. Like, every day, is something going to happen? Is something going to happen? Nobody really knows.
With the prosecution walking away from the case, is it safe to assume that the case is over, that the judge will dismiss the charges?
Well, I would think so, yes. I mean, I think anything can happen. One issue would be if she doesn't want to dismiss the case, like, who would take it? Is there someone else who could take it? The Utah Attorney General's office cannot, because they are conflicted. The federal government, which essentially initiated these investigations, has already recused themselves and decided not to prosecute, so it couldn't go back that direction. So I would expect that it will be dismissed. One question will be, you know, on what merits will she, because under the court rules, it's not like first come, first served. You filed your motion first, so you win, or, you know, and I'm second, so I lose. The judge can look at the judge can and is required to look at all of those motions and decide on which merits she dismisses the case.
We have a caller, Carl from St. George, who thinks that these latest developments are a travesty of justice. Carl, you're on Behind the Headlines.
Yes, I can't even believe what's going on and what I'm hearing concerning this case with Shurtleff and Swallow. In the first place, I think it was a real coup that these high-profile individuals in Utah were even charged with these crimes. And I remember when, and this has been, over a year ago, this has been going on for some time. There were evidences that came out, or at least there were stories that came out, of actual incidences in receiving gifts and giving favors and so on that involved this Johnson fellow down here from St. George. And it went clear to Mike Lee and Harry Reid in the United States Senate to try to quash this thing. And I think this is a quintessential example of why people are losing faith in the judicial system and in politics. And when Trump and Bernie Sanders talk about a rigged system, this is it. When you get these high-profile people that are rich, powerful, well-connected, and can hire these defense attorneys that just keep throwing paper at this thing and watering it down and watering it down, and time is the enemy, why that we just let this thing go? You were saying it's hard to prosecute public corruption, and it's in the best interest to walk away. Hell, this is a big case. These are public officials that have been on the take. And you people that are in charge of the press, why isn't there somebody that can stand up and really lay down what the charges have been?
Carl, we'll put that to Jennifer Doebner. Jennifer, as Carl says, this was a big case involving many high-profile elected and officials and business persons. With the abandonment of these charges against Shurtleff, what does this mean for the case against his successor, John Swallow, and some of these other charges that are lingering, accusations, I should say?
Well, in Swallow's case, he's being prosecuted by the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office, and Sim Gill, the DA, has said that his case is going forward. Certainly, there's a lot of overlap in the Shurtleff and Swallow cases, but some of the elements of Swallow's case are different. And Sim feels that, you know, he and his staff have sufficient evidence to move forward. In Shurtleff's case, there have been allegations raised, questions raised about the quality of some of the evidence and about whether or not some of the federal, the FBI agents and the state police investigators who worked on the case have told the truth in some of their affidavits. And so I think that complicated the issue for Troy Rawlings in Davis County. But Rawlings, I should say, is not done. He has been working for many, many months to get a state grand jury. And what we know from what we can sort of divine in court documents and a couple of stories that and he's commented on the record for myself and Tom Harvey, that he is looking at allegations of a possible bribe involving John Swallow and an attempt to bribe Nevada Senator Harry Reid, an effort that was sort of coordinated through John Swallow with Jeremy Johnson, the St. George businessman that our caller has referenced. That's not going away. Shurtleff is potentially a witness for Rawlings in any grand jury proceeding. There are some questions about Mike Lee's campaign that have come up in the context of this effort to get a grand jury. There's some questions about UTA and front runner stations in parts of the Salt Lake Valley, which have come up as part of the questions around a possible grand jury investigation. And so I think that while there may be disappointment that the actual charges against Shurtleff himself may go away, there will be other things that come out of this. If Troy Rawlings gets his way, essentially.
Troy Rawlings mentioned the issue of an individual's right to a speedy trial. It's been the same 2 years for John Swallow. Could this open up avenues for John Swallow to complain about similar time?
Well, Swallow waived his right. When one of the options in the court system is, because nobody gets a speedy trial, is to waive your right. And Mr. Shurtleff had never done that. Mr. Swallow did in December of 2014, so very early in his case. He had a previous attorney. His current attorney probably thinks that was a bad idea, but they can't really go back in time and change that. So that issue is not it's not really on the table for him. But there are questions in that case as well, because the evidence came from the same state and federal investigators. Those questions have been raised They have their own challenges. They also have filed a motion to dismiss on the grounds that a set of emails that was protected communications between Swallow and the attorney representing him during the investigation in 2012 and 2013, that those have been essentially scattered throughout all the other evidence, and that privileged information has now been read by investigators and prosecutors. Now, Gill's office says that hasn't happened. They had a hearing a couple weeks ago before the judge to say, we don't think we can get a fair trial because all of you know, the early defense strategies and have been exposed. So it's messy. I'll give you that. It's very, very messy.
Well, and a report today says that it could be taxpayers who foot the bill for these legal maneuverings. What's happening there?
Well, so there's a Utah law that protects public servants, essentially, if they're accused of any sort of wrongdoing and prosecuted for something that they do, you know, some act that they carry out in the course of doing their jobs. So if a defendant who is a public servant either is acquitted or has their case dismissed on their own motion, then they are eligible to apply for funds from the state to pay their legal fees. It's happened. It happens a lot, but most of the cases are pretty minor. I think maybe Nancy Workman from Salt Lake County, the former mayor of Salt Lake County, is the last sort of high-profile case, and she got $100,000 from Salt Lake County to pay her lawyers. So this could happen, but The cases have to be dismissed first.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. Lots of moving pieces still in those stories. Thank you, Jennifer. Listeners, you can follow any updates to the Swallow and Shurtleff investigations at sltrib.com. The hour has flown by, and we're going to move to our final segment of the show, the Underplayed Stories of the Week, where we look at important and meaningful stories that maybe flew under the public radar. Jennifer Dobner, let's start with you. Your thoughts on an underplayed story this week?
Self-promotion, shamelessly. 2 days ago, Salt Lake County prosecutors finally filed misdemeanor assault charges against two Wyoming men who pretty viciously beat up a couple of gay men from Salt Lake City in December of 2014. The case was used to renew an effort to pass hefty hate crimes laws in Utah this last legislative session, and that failed again for, I don't know, the umpteenth time in probably 20 years of trying. I think the misdemeanor counts are pretty insufficient probably for the injuries, but we'll see how that goes forward.
Mm-hmm. And in your story, Sim Gill was quoted pretty critical of the current hate crimes laws.
Yeah, the laws only apply in misdemeanor cases, so you can't, like in this case, one of the victims, Rusty Andrade, has some fairly severe ongoing injuries and that seem like they should be the equivalent of a felony level punishment, but he can't get there because the law won't let them. The current law has no teeth, and prosecutors have been asking for that for a number of years with no help from the legislature.
And Gill's been one of the prominent prosecutors lobbying for a change in that law.
He has, and obviously Salt Lake City has, you know, one of the largest populations in the state, and so we see more of these crimes, and there's not really anything anybody can do. You can't get past a Class A misdemeanor, and that's only a year in the county jail punishment if someone's convicted, and they feel that's insufficient because hate crimes, you know, are message crimes, and they terrorize a section of the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Jennifer. Emma Penrod, your underplayed story this week.
So some air quality news that unfortunately got swamped out by algae news. There was a settlement between the EPA and Tesoro that's going to have as a result, about $150 million worth of pollution controls will be installed at the Salt Lake City refinery. This settled accusations that they had violated the Clean Air Act related to leak detection and repair at refineries in Alaska, California, Hawaii, North Dakota, Utah, and Washington. So it's part of a bigger settlement, not just a local settlement. But the EPA is saying that they feel satisfied with this resolution because they believe it will remove several hundred tons of pollutants from the local airshed.
Mm-hmm. Dan Harry, your underplayed story this week.
I'm going to stick with the environment, too, and talk about the a new Utah Court of Appeals ruling that supported water rights for a proposed nuclear plant in Green River, Utah. And this is interesting. I mean, we're still a long way from having a nuclear power plant in Utah. Long way, years away, and billions of dollars away. But this was really, the water rights issue was the only one over which Utah had any control. All the rest of us now would move to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and into the federal system, which, you know, has a lot of complications and twists and turns. But this really was the only Utah decision to be made in this issue of a nuclear power plant.
Mm-hmm. And Alex Stuckey, an underplayed story this week.
I'm not sure if this counts as underplayed, but I think a story that kind of stuck with me this week was probably because I was sitting next to the reporter reporting on it, was the story that we had about the father and son who were both in Big River playing the runaway slave. And it's kind of an interesting, there's eight kids and they're all super musical. One of them is a Grammy Award winning songwriter, and it's not, we don't have very many happy stories like that. So I think that's my story.
Great, thank you. Lastly, my pick, a new state audit claims that at least $67,000 was stolen over 4 years from the Utah Schools for the Deaf and Blind. I spoke with State Auditor John Dougal, who told me it's likely the embezzlement went on for longer than 4 years and was more expensive. So we'll be following that. Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, Alex Stuckey, Jennifer Dobner, thank you all for being here today.
Thanks, thank Ben.
Thanks.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks about the rules of watching the Days of 47 parade.
Pioneer Day is coming up, and a couple of years back, you wrote a column on the rules of watching the parade, because it turns out that there are some rules, and I was wondering if we could hear some of those, Robert Kirby.
Well, there are some rules and there are some laws. Over the years, the 24th of July Pioneer Day parade has changed a lot. And what people have done as customary before that wasn't against the law has now become against the law in order to maintain, you know, some semblance of organization down there. So in this column, I wrote, here are the rules. Claim staking. If there's a spot on South Temple or State Street where your family has watched the parade since Brigham Young's 11th wife, you still can't reserve it until after 8 p.m. the night before. This speaks to the issue of throwing out chairs and everything on your spot. After 8 p.m., it is permitted to reserve a spot, but only for yourself. You can't reserve 200 linear feet of curb for your entire clan unless their butts are actually there to sit on it. All vehicles must be removed from the street along the parade route the night before, which means you can't park a fifth-wheel trailer or a motorhome from which to watch the parade in air-conditioned comfort. Nor is it permitted to block the sidewalk in order to cram your entire family into the space from where you've always watched the parade.
You know, I'm wondering who is in charge of regulating all of this activity. You're going down the street. You've got families the night before going out trying to carve out their space. Is there an enforcement mechanism?
Yep, there is. The police department.
Okay.
They've been tasked with keeping avenues open for emergency vehicles, keeping people from trampling each other, making sure that people can walk from one end of the street, that a sidewalk stays a sidewalk, instead of just a really hard place to sit.
It's a bit of a free-for-all. You also write about a sensitive issue, which is dogs.
People and their dogs, yeah. No dogs are allowed along the parade route after 6 p.m. the night before, with the exception of the pets of people living along the route and actual service dogs. And by actual, the city means dogs that assist the physically disabled rather than any old dog that just makes a person feel good about himself.
You know, it's all these rules, a busy downtown, a hot July day. Robert Kirby, I have to ask you, do you go and watch the parade?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. I've noticed over 40-some-odd years that the parade has changed a lot.
How and so? What did it used to be?
In the ideas that are behind some of the floats and things like that, things that are promoted now wouldn't have been promotable, say, in 1950, that sort of thing. And it's gotten bigger, but it's also gotten more controllable as they've come to anticipate problems and check on them.
Do you have a? Is there something that you wait for every year during the parade? One float or entry that you're especially interested in?
I like floats with attractive women on them. You know, so that's any of those will actually work.
It's an easy answer. One thing I've noticed at a couple of parades that I've been to over the years is generally people are very cordial, friendly to each other, but there are those instances where an altercation might occur because of, say, the space that people are trying to claim along the route.
Oh, yeah. It's like claim jumping during the gold rush. You know, people get their back up if they feel that they're being encroached upon. And so there's always going to be problems. That's why you see the police out there. Have to settle the matters before they get violent and hurt some kid or something.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions and the Kirby Archives at SaltLakeSLTrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Benjamin Wood. Thanks for joining us today. Roger McDonough will be back next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.